Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Bob Hoy from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The North American exchanges really took it on the chin Friday. We asked Bob if sell in May and go away has come a week early. Kaiser Watch's John Kaiser is here to talk about the junior mining sector, his bottom fish favorites, gold's future, and where the money in the juniors is flowing. InsideTrackTrading.com CEO and President Eric Haddock examines the cycles that affect the Dow, inflation, interest rates, gold, and even cryptocurrencies. We'll talk to Bob Hoy right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Bob Hoy. He's a market historian and chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com in Vancouver. Welcome to This Week in Money, Bob.
Yeah, Jim, good to be with you.
Bob, has sell in May and go away come a week early? The North American markets really took it on the chin Friday.
Oh, yeah, Jim, that's what I've been mumbling about for the last couple of months and allowing a little elbow room to stretch it out to maybe mid-year. But the phenomenon is in financial history whereby if there's going to be good times, it'll be from October until around May in the stock market. And also that shows up in other items like credit spreads and bonds and stuff like that. So, in the last, like the Dow was down 900 on Friday. That's a bit of a hit, 2.8% or something like that. And the other one that within this, Jim, that's important is what we call the breadth or the health of the stock market. And that's the comparison between the number of stocks that are going up on the big board and the number that are going down. It's called the advanced decline line. And that, when it is rising, is supportive to the stock market. And in the full-fledged bull market, let's sort of say that all stocks are going up. And then that line reached its best in November, and then they started a decline and got hit rather hard earlier in the year, did somewhat of a recovery, and as of today's close on it, it's getting close to taking out the last low. The stock market, internals, is not healthy. Another one is that in my work on the history of great financial bubbles, is that when the stock market peaks, and within a great financial bubble, which they kind of run for a decade, they become so big, the financial side becomes so big relative to the economy. And a lot of the economy is reliant upon financial speculation as such that when the market rolls over and heads down, usually the economy is fairly close to that. Now, I've spent a long time in the investment business, and in ordinary markets, the stock market will peak, and then the economy keeps going up, and maybe peaking usually about 10 to 12 months later. And indeed, the organization that keeps track of the leading indicators, they include the S&P in it, but that only works in normal times. When you're in great financial bubbles, it does not work. So what one should be looking for now is if the stock market breaks down and the advanced decline line takes out the previous low, this is serious. And what it will be suggesting is that the economy is heading south as well. And this stands to reason because the economic, the post-bubble contraction started in Argentina and Turkey in March a year ago. Then in June, China's great economy began to falter. And then now with the sanctions against Russia, you've got the economy in Eastern Europe weakening. And this always ends up hitting the world's financial center, which is now New York. So we're talking about a bleak week here, Jim.
How did gold do?
Yeah, gold is trading near highs, and the problem with a post-bubble contraction is that the really careful money goes to the most liquid items, and the most liquid items are shorter than 1 year treasury bills in the senior currency, which is the U.S. dollar. So that's the kind of money that doesn't look necessarily for a return. It just wants to be put park it where it can get it back. And shorter than 1 year maturity treasuries are a good place to be. So then that also puts in a bid for the U.S. dollar. So in the dollar today was up to, the DX, as we call it, was up to 101, new high for the move. And since earlier in the year, we've had a target of 103. Hey, it's getting close. And especially when that was back when it was 91. So here we are. So you got that. But then also another item of liquidity is gold. So you have a bid for gold. But that leaves gold shares, they're equities. And if the major stock market sells off, the gold stocks will sell off. And we're expecting that. But our technical work is such that on the next oversold, like the next buying opportunity, I'm pretty sure we'll be able to identify it, because if this great financial mania, which has been on for a long time, is over, then what happens is that gold's real price, relative to inflation and relative to the cost of mining and all that sort of stuff, go up, so that then you, in each post-bubble contraction in the past, you've had a long bull market for the gold sector. So, and it's not just that gold stocks go up, but they would outperform measures such as the Standard & Poor's. So the gold sector is going to become very important. And as I say, with our technical analysis, we should be able to spot, well, you can't quite do it, but we're able to identify an oversold market at about the right time, and then that's when we would be buyers of gold stocks. So, and in the meantime, very safe money. Bank deposits and CDs and things like that, or just plain cash, treasury bills, whatever, those returns are going to go to zero. So one of the things, and you have to be dealing with an experienced broker to find these, is find about a four-year good grade corporate bond, and it'll give you a higher yield. The risk is not that all that much, because they're going to be redeemed at par, say, 4 years hence. And then for Canadians, you can buy U.S. Corporate bonds, good grade, about that same maturity, and you'll get the rise in the U.S. dollar, which is likely to continue relative to the Canadian dollar. So there are some practical things that one can do out there. Just to wrap it up, get liquid, reduce debt, and find very safe havens for the liquidity that you do raise.
Bob, thank you so much for the update.
Jim, good to be with you, and we look forward to another time.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Coming up, John Kaiser, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with John Kaiser. He's the producer of Kaiser Watch, which you can find online at kaiserresearch.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, pleasure to be back on This Week in Money.
How are things going at Kaiser Research and on Kaiser Watch?
Things are going quite well, Jim. I finished the migration of Kaiser Research into the cloud in December, so the site works much better than it was last year. We've done 14 episodes of Kaiser Watch. I have this format where I produce a unrestricted blog item, post it when the YouTube version is available, and I'm able to include graphics to illustrate what we're talking about on the audio show. And the shows have had, you know, from 300 to 1,700 views in the past 3 months since we launched it in January. And in terms of subscribers and that's still relatively calm. It's a good sign that we are still in the early stages of a resource junior bull market. People are content to consume the free unrestricted material. But yes, things are going quite well. And I'm very pleased that I've launched Kaiser Watch as an independent show.
Do you have a number of junior mining companies that you keep a close eye on for subscribers at KaiserResearch.com?
Well, Kaiser Research is an information platform that has about 2,200, 2,300 companies that are in the resource sector that are listed on the ASX and the TSX and TSX Venture and CSE. And I have a filter search system where I cull that down to a small group. I've got a couple hundred that I flagged as bottom fish spec value rated, and I've currently got 8 favorites, which are do not have any sort of a major missing piece like a typical bottom fish has that keeps it along a bottom, crawling along a bottom. And I'm having a lot of fun. In fact, I don't have enough time to research and write up all these interesting bottom fish stories that are out there. I've got the Slack forum space, which is sort of like a private stockhouse room. It's got 30 channels. All the KRO members are part of it. And in a sense, they're helping me out because they ask questions. They point out the juniors that I may have overlooked. So we have this kind of collaborative forum that runs in parallel to the Kaiser Research website where I can post a quick comment on the fly and banter with subscribers. So I'm enjoying myself a lot. I think we're heading into a major resource junior bull cycle that will have minimum 3 to 5 years to run, even if we have a flack in the general market. About 200 bottom fish that I'm keeping a close eye on and 8 favorites, and some of these bottom fish hopefully graduate to favorite status later this year.
For the junior miners, does this year look like it could be a sell in May and go away?
Well, compared to the activity in the first quarter of last year, overall traded value has been lower. And that's, of course, because we've seen the air go out of the tech bubble. All the non-resource stocks are losing market interest. And since mid-December, on the TS Venture, the resource listings have traded more than 50% of the total traded value. And last year, they were mainly down in the 30 to 40% range. In fact, in the last 6-7 years, they have been less than 50% as cannabis and blockchain, crypto, all these other non-resource stories dominated the junior scene. The only exception was in that May to August period of 2020 when gold ran up to over $2,000. That's when the resource juniors on the venture exchange were more than 50%. But it's interesting, the percent represented by the resource juniors on the venture exchange, it keeps creeping higher. For the first part of the year, it was in the 50 to 60% range. Now it's in the 60 to 65% range. So is this suddenly going to end? I think we see a shift in the market's attention from non-resource stories to these resource stories, but the total traded value is still considerably lower than it was last year, especially in the first quarter where we had a huge blow-off for the non-resource stocks. the resource stocks sort of tagged along, but then they sagged in the second quarter and were pretty lame for most of last year. May that sell in May and go away. There is not the big strength that that usually is required for people in the second quarter to start giving up and go away for the summer. I think this year it will continue to strengthen through the second quarter, and we still have these big 6 to 8 week delays for assay turnaround. So stuff that was done in the first quarter will start arriving in the third quarter as summer begins. So there will be a news flow that keeps the audience's attention, and metal prices, as long as they stay strong as they have been, I think the resource juniors will continue to gain market share and start increasing the traded value.
How is the flow of money into the junior miners doing this year compared to other years?
This year, the money raised in the first quarter was less than it was in the first quarter of last year. Last year, we had that huge sort of expected post-COVID rebound that then later fizzled. But it is still strong and not quite as good as last year, but it is strong. And again, we've been through a rough quarter with the interest rates rising, inflation going way up. People are concerned that when they raise the interest rates, they'll tank the economy and then metal prices will go down. I think the circumstances are different this time. Inflation will not go down because this is really being caused by supply problems, not by too much money chasing the existing supply. It is a curtailment of supply due to geopolitical conflict, the Russia sanctions situation, China's zero COVID policy, which has all these ships snarled in the harbors waiting to get onshore, waiting for trucks to be allowed to move goods. We're going to see that inflation go up, and we will see the economy sag. But I think the resource juniors, the metals and that, they will stay high, and people will realize that the world is changing, that with deglobalization, you can't count on cheap stuff from China anymore. You're going to have to develop your domestic sources. And with the Russia-China alliance that was forged earlier this year, I don't think there's any way that a globalized trade can resume as it was in the prior 20, 30 years when it facilitated the rise of China into the second largest economy.
Has the way junior mining companies are promoted changed over the last few years?
The COVID pandemic, with all the restrictions of movement, gathering in places, it really killed the in-person conferences. There's one coming up in May, which I will be attending. The last one was in November it was very sparsely attended. And that was, of course, during the flu season with the new Omicron just starting to emerge. And then everything got canceled in the first quarter because of restrictions due to the contagiousness of Omicron. Right now, they've gotten rid of all the mask mandates. We do have the BA.2 variant starting to surge. So far, those who are vaccinated simply have a lousy flu or cold experience from it. But I'm not sure what the regulators are going to do about restricting people going into conference spaces. And conferences, physical conferences, they really work well for people to interact, press the flesh, as they say, look people in the eye, overhear conversations, learn a lot about what's going on. The whole sort of virtual Zoom type of reality, people are tired of that. It's sort of pretty much a one-way downloading of content that sucks up linear time. And in terms of marketing stocks, I think the social media viral networks are still important. Newsletters aren't very important anymore because people don't feel they should pay for any sort of information, and even when it's valuable, it gets pushed around in the social media networks for free, basically ripping off intellectual property and sharing it on an unlimited basis. So companies really need to put a lot of effort into crafting their story, making sure it has an evolving script, a timeline that people can say, okay, in 2 months we hear what this is, we'll find out if this target turned into a big discovery or not, and if not, what's the next plan coming on? And they still need to do good sort of video presentations that they put online, YouTube, and link to on their website to accompany their PowerPoint presentations. They need to refresh them on a regular basis, especially PowerPoints. If you're not, at the very minimum, putting the current month's date on it to tell everybody this is the information is up to date, then you're neglecting your ability to attract an audience.
When you're researching junior mining companies, what weighting do you put on the jockey and what weighting do you put on the horse?
You know, it has to be almost an equal weighting. I mean, I have this analogy of I've discovered this enormous horse, that fantastic horse that I'm absolutely convinced is going to win this race. I put all my money on it. And then I see the rodeo clown mounting this horse, and I have that sinking feeling. This horse is not going to win the race because this rodeo clown specializes in riding the horse facing backwards. So, and of course, if you have some really sharp-looking jockey, and he mounts or she mounts a nag, well, that nag is not going to go anywhere. So you need to have a strong story and a strong management team, a CEO who knows how to tell the story, who knows strategic planning, who is constantly thinking ahead of the curve, how to deal with all the things that can go wrong in the junior resource sector, especially with the discovery exploration sector. And they have to know how to sell, how to raise money, and you know, weave the dream. Get people thinking about what is the size of the prize, what is the bet that they are making. Because if you cannot get money into a company, even though you can be a great talker and it can be a great story, the story can't go anywhere without exploration, feasibility, demonstration, capital.
Has COVID changed the junior mining market?
COVID had a very negative impact in the past 2 years on the logistics of the mining sector. Permitting departments were working from home, working slowly. It was taking a very long time to get drill permits, to get anything done. Assay labs went from sort of typical 3 to 6 week turnaround to like 2 to 3 month turnaround. It also became difficult to get drillers and, you know, field people working in the field. All these COVID protocols made things difficult. And the biggest negative impact has been the delay between spending, putting the money in the ground on exploration activity and finding out what the results are so that you know whether you're on the right track and where to pivot to. And for projects that are seasonal, such as the Golden Triangle, this has been brutal. I mean, it is terrible that you get your summer exploration results from the Golden Triangle in January, February of the following year. By then, everybody's given up waiting for the results. And yes, you may have shown photos of good visuals, but until you get the assays, especially for the precious metals like gold, you really have no idea what the results truly mean. So COVID had what hopefully was a temporary negative effect on the ability of companies to get work done on a timely basis and disclose the results so that they can do follow-up work within the field season, even when it's already funded, and to raise additional money if they have made pulled a discovery hole that says, okay, now we need to do delineation drilling, and for that we need a lot more money. This lag has been brutal for the junior resource sector.
Which junior mining sectors are you currently focused on?
I'm interested in the whole spectrum. Everything is impacted by major changes that are happening in the world. This 10-year bear market that we went through with the junior, and it was a 5-year bear market for the majors. The majors had overspent in response to the China super cycle. They got punished in the market. Metal prices weakened in the past 5 years. the Wall Street and so on said, you're not going to spend money acquiring new projects and building them. You're going to just focus on streamlining your operations and making sure that you can pay dividends or at least buy back the stock in the market and keep the stock price propped up. So there is now a development hole in the supply pipeline. At the same time, this idea of globalized trade is collapsing. The world is fragmenting into autocratic versus democratic zones where there's not going to be this fluid flow of raw materials to whoever's willing to pay the highest price. And there's also the ESG component that's kicking in and the energy transition, which if it is pulled off, requires a significant new amount of metals such as copper and also brand new demand for metals such as lithium and even tin that had not really had any growth for decades before this. And so with this pulling back into more secure jurisdictions and no longer relying on the Congo for all your cobalt and copper, relying on China for rare earths, and with these new demands kicking in, I'm interested in all the critical metal sectors, the base metal sectors, and of course the precious metal sectors. This fragmentation of the global economy, the squaring off of big power rivalry between the China-Russia alliance and the United States and Europe, this is going to impact the role of the U.S. dollar as the world's sole reserve currency. And gold is going to bridge that transition. It's going to see its value go up. And the gold supply has not been increasing in the last 5 years. It's actually declined somewhat. So even as the total global economy grows, gold's share of that is a declining amount, which is not going to be boosted in the short term through new supply, but its share can increase through a greater value for gold. And I don't think the market has really yet accepted that $1,900 gold plus or minus $100 is the new reality. They're still trembling with fear that it's going to crash back to $1,300 and that something like Bitcoin's going to command $12 trillion worth of value, which is what gold commands roughly right now. So until that fear goes away, this is still very much an excellent market to position yourself across the spectrum in all the metals. And the countries such as the United States, they're finally waking up that their dependency on other jurisdictions to do the dirty stuff of mining and processing, that's not going to work anymore. And they have, you know, created their environmental rules that are tougher than anywhere else in the world. The industry has learned how to adapt to this. So the situation, the conditions are ripe for a major boom of mining, and all these anti-mining NIMBY people, they're going to have to scurry back into the holes that they crawled out of and let countries like Canada and the United States build the mines that are going to keep their economies going in a fragmented global economy.
What is the average size of a junior mining investor's portfolio?
Well, that question is somewhat ambiguous. There are high net worth people who have investments in the resource juniors. There are low net worth people who have investments. It's a question of what portion of your overall investment portfolio are you allocating to a high risk category. And the problem that we've had in the past decade, you know, since 2012 when the resource junior bear market arrived, is that the low and high net worth investors have been allocating their risk capital more to non-resource stories. I mentioned earlier how the traded value on the venture exchange was more than 50% for anything but the resource listings. And right now, since I'm not a brokerage firm or anything, I don't get to see what is in people's accounts. So I'd love to have the answer to that. It would help me better understand the structure. But my guess is that the portion that people have in the resource junior sector is much smaller than it used to be. And that is a bit of a concern to me, that this whole idea of speculating on fundamental outcomes rather than just doing momentum gambling, this trend that evolved, that got accelerated by the pandemic period with crazy things like GameStop, I'm concerned that we may never get the audience back for the resource juniors. However, there is now so much coverage of the supply problems happening that somewhere there's going to be a tipping point where people say, screw these non-resource stories. I mean, when Netflix goes from $700 down $500 and then that starts happening to all these other high-tech flyers, people are going to say, I think I'm going to stick with the boringness of resource juniors and their discovery feasibility demonstration plays. That inflection point is coming, and hopefully the portion of capital that they've got allocated to high risk that they're willing to put into resource juniors increases. And the resource junior space's valuation is so small relative to all these other categories that it really wouldn't take much of an inflow of risk capital to really push the numbers up so that everybody starts taking notice and says, oh, this is the new game in town. Oh, this is an old game. I wonder if anything has changed in the past decade.
Do junior mining stockbrokers still have a role to play?
You know, the 25 years ago, the emergence of discount brokers completely altered the role that brokers played. The emergence of the internet also changed it. The brokers used to be information network hubs. The promoters talked to the brokers. The brokers would go down to the bars and that after the market closed. They would pick up scuttlebutt, and then they would pass it on to their clients, primarily by phone. When the internet came along, basic information was ubiquitous. When the social media chat channels and that showed up, then those became the rumor mill hubs. And the regulators at the same time clamped down on what full-service brokers can do. And, of course, full-service brokers have to charge more money, more commission than the discount brokers. So people who are gambling on a whole range of, resource junior stocks, they're not going to talk to their broker about it because that broker will have a short list of approved stocks that he or she can talk about. And the brokers themselves have shifted more to a fee-based system. The less time they talk to the client, the better off they are. They want a percentage of the portfolio's value, park it into conservative positions and track index funds so that they never really do much worse than the market in general. So, and in terms of financing, they only really get involved when the financing is a much bigger number. You know, they're not going to do a $1 million, $2 million financing. If it's a $10 million financing a company's doing, then the brokers will participate and park it in their sort of high net worth clients' accounts. But for all these smaller juniors, the brokers, they are a lost cause. And this is a change that is permanent. It's not going to go back to the brokers playing an important role in the funding and talking about the resource junior stories.
Are the junior mining markets in Canada continuing to be over-regulated?
The resource juniors have 43-101 national instrument, which is a reporting requirement, which non-resource stories do not have. If you have a cannabis deal, you can say pretty much what you want about your business plan because everybody knows a business plan is simply a dream. But you cannot do that with the resource juniors. Quantifying the size of your prize that you think you will drill into, that is completely forbidden. So the rules require the companies to put out all these little spots or dots all over the map, which the market is expected to connect. And I think this handicaps the resource juniors in an unfair way. It would have been better to just make it easier to distinguish between what is my exploration potential outcome, why we think this is there, and make it very clear that this is not the same thing as a 43-101 resource estimate or an economic study that has been signed off on by qualified professionals. It's now become almost this control-free, qualified professional world where nothing can be said unless it is done within this QP 43-101 framework. And when the investor can't see what the potential reward is, if the company is right with what it's doing, why do you want to place a bet? And I've, you know, created things like outcome visualization to bridge that gap, but the companies themselves can't really do that, and that hurts the juniors. And also the way that they do not let people who aren't millionaires do private placements without really complicated rules, I think that is a disgrace, because resource junior plays, they range from very big ones to small ones, and the small one can end up becoming a huge discovery. And by denying the ability of people who want to invest $5,000, $10,000, maybe $20,000 in a private placement, that is a disgrace, especially as we mentioned earlier, the brokers themselves are not playing any meaningful advice role anymore with regard to the resource juniors.
March 31st of 2023, courtesy of the Trudeau government, flow-through financing will end for oil and gas and coal exploration. How is this likely to affect the oil, gas, and coal juniors?
It shouldn't affect them at all. The whole point of flow-through is to encourage companies to explore, make new discoveries. And the metal market is very different from the fossil fuel market. In the case of oil and gas, there aren't that many places left in Canada where you can drill wildcat holes and make a field discovery. That's the sort of high-risk venture for which flow-through would make sense. In terms of coal, everybody knows where the coal seams are, and nobody wants to hear about drilling deep and finding a seam that has to be mined underground. There's plenty of open pit mineable coal. And also the oil and gas sector has shifted to models such as hydraulic fracking, the fracking sector. This is more like, put money together, apply the technology, and it doesn't take long to start flowing the gas or the oil that you get out of this. So flow through as an incentive is not necessary for that. It is important for exploration because the failure risk in the resource juniors, the metal juniors, is much, much higher. The development cycle is awful. I mean, you go from grassroots to mine development. That's a minimum 6 to 9 year process during which the metal price can change to a point where suddenly you're ready to go into production and gold tanks 25%, and suddenly your project's going to lose money unless you've managed to forward sell everything. And so the Canadian government withdrawing flow through, and this is the first I've heard of this, I assume this is correct. I think it's an inconsequential development. It's clearly politically motivated to do something about reducing reliance on fossil fuels. They did at the same time introduce a new extra flow-through credit for what they call critical metals. This is a pretty big list. And the way flow-through works now, there's 100% write-off of whatever money you put in. And then there is a 15% markup on that that you can also deduct. This new critical metal flow-through replaces the 15% with a 30% markup. So if you invest in a company looking for lithium in Ontario, you'll be able to get a 130% write-off. And the justification for flow-through was that because the resource junior game is really a statistics game where the majority of exploration efforts fail, the company passes on the write-off to the investor, who then gets a tax benefit out of it. So the taxpayer is indirectly subsidizing the exploration effort. In the fossil fuel sector, there isn't this high failure risk, so it doesn't really require this tax incentive to stimulate this collective exploration activity of hundreds of ventures out of which maybe come, you know, a couple of important new mines every year, and keep the supply of metals coming for a country like Canada.
How is inflation affecting the junior mining market?
Well, of course, inflation is going to affect the cost of exploration insofar as you have a feasibility demonstration play where you're working on a PEA and an economic study and moving it up to PFS. Now we are looking at a situation where the PEA done last year, when they publish the PFS next year, are the costs, how much will the costs have gone up? How much will the net present value have sunk? At the same time, the inflation is also pushing up the metal prices. Metal prices are at astonishing levels. They are higher than they were at the sort of peak of the China super cycle. There are metals such as uranium which have not yet recovered to the bubble peak of 2006-07, but that's because there are supply demand issues affecting that market. But metal prices are really quite high. And again, what I think is holding the market back is they're thinking, okay, metal prices are high. We should be investing in these exploration projects. But here we've got inflation coming. Metal prices theoretically should also go up with inflation. But inflation is going to result in monetary policy tightening, interest rates going up, a recession emerging. Drops demand for raw materials. So the prices of the metals are going to go down, even though the prices for, getting stuff done, they rarely go down quickly. So the market's living in fear that this inflation cycle will demolish the high metal prices. It's not quite ready en masse to rise to the bait and say, nah, this is a window. There's a supply deficit, structural supply deficit coming. It needs to be filled. Metal prices will stay persistently high, even if we get a recession that eventually does lower the costs of other inputs for the that make a mine. So it's affecting it in that sense. There is a point where when they realize inflation's not going away, it may give legs to the gold bugs again and spur gold over $2,000 and put it on a charge towards the $3,000 level. If that started to happen, that would affect the juniors in a big way, because the optics of gold doing that, they override any sort of underlying mathematics, which might suggest that, though, at the end of the day, your marginal gold deposit, the low grade, is still going to be marginal because the costs will have eaten up or kept track with the price of gold. So that's, it's the prospect of it is harming them in this perceptual way, but I think even though it will persist, it's going to end up benefiting the juniors.
John, where can people find out more about Kaiser Research and Kaiser Watch?
Very simple. You go to kaiserresearch.com. You'll see something called the Favorites Dashboard. That gives you access to the unrestricted material on my favorites, and check out the link that has the Kaiser Watch archive. You can catch up on all past issues, and I do break it down into questions, so that if you don't want to hear about Verde Agritech, which went from 25 cents 2 years ago to now is over $10, but want to hear about the other 25 centers, it's all broken down so that you can see the question. Aha, here's the one that I want to talk about or hear about. Click on it and it'll take you to YouTube, and you can listen to what I have to say for 5-10 minutes on that particular topic. So you can pick and choose whatever it is you want to listen to on Kaiser Watch, or if you're stuck on a big long commute, you can get the podcast downloaded onto your smartphone and just listen to me drone on while you drive through your commuter traffic to your job or wherever it is that you're going.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me on the This Week in Money, Jim.
My guest has been John Kaiser, producer and editor of Kaiser Watch. Coming up, Eric Haddock, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California near Fresno. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, how are things going at Inside Track Trading, and can you tell us about your various newsletters?
Yeah, things are going pretty well, and really the primary newsletters that we have are a monthly newsletter titled Inside Track, which comes with or without, depending on your choosing, intra-month updates, and then a little more frequent and numbers-intensive and trade-intensive publication is the weekly relay, which is published with intra-week alerts. And then we've got many reports and other types of periodic publications that are included with that subscription. So it's those two primary vehicles that we offer to traders and investors.
Are the various sectors of the stock markets in different cycles right now?
You know, I would say that the cycles, the overriding cycles, are still pretty much the same for each of the sectors. But certainly when you get into your short-term swings, you will see different sectors, different indexes, setting highs when other indexes, I should say setting higher highs when others are setting lower highs, or vice versa with the lows. You get some of them setting, you know, new six-month lows, whereas others are bottoming out above their previous lows and starting to show signs of a bottom forming. That type of divergence you've seen consistently over the last year, and it actually helps in timing some of the expected turning points, because when you see certain markets just being able to breach previous highs while others have already given a sell signal and kind of rebounded, that kind of clues you in to kind of a final high in a sequence of highs, whether that's just a daily situation or a weekly one. But that's the type of disparity that I see between the different sectors, is more something to do with extent and magnitude as opposed to being completely different cycles.
Is the Dow in a cycle where it could continue to have legs to the upside, and for how long?
I think that all of the indexes are in a topping phase that I talked about throughout last year, explained why I thought that 2022 was the convergence of multi-year, multi-decade, and even some multi-generational cycles, where I thought we would see a very significant top form during the year. But with something of that magnitude, you'll see a lot of what I was just describing as far as those divergent highs, but now you're spreading it out over many months to where even late last year you saw this happening, where some of the indexes peaked in early November and then they sold off, and then there was a rebound into early January where a couple key indexes set new highs for their some new all-time highs, some on a multi-month basis, whereas others set lower highs, and that triggered that sell-off. I think you're going to see similar situations in a couple of key time frames this year before a major peak, when all of the indexes have, have kind of hit their extremes have topped out. As for the Dow and some a little bit more near-term cycles, the last several weeks, my focus has been on a very consistent 14 to 15 week cycle in the Dow Industrials that more recently, as we saw the price action leading into late March, when a lot of the indexes set some initial multi-week highs, then you pulled back. The Dow Industrials was about the only primary index that I follow that did not signal that late March top should hold for a month or more. It kept showing me that the industrials would at least spike to a higher high during the time frame we're in right now. In particular, the week of April 18th to the 22nd is the 15th week of this 14 to 15 week cycle. And all I need to see is the Dow Industrials spiking a little bit above their late March high while many of the other indexes remain negative. That would set the stage for a divergent high on a short-term basis and probably trigger a bit of a sell-off from there. So the industrials are something that is a little bit stronger than the other indexes on a relative basis right now, but that continues to cycle in and out between the different indexes. I've got some tools that are telling me the NASDAQ 100 is probably during this pullback, once, you know, if the Dow Industrials do what I expect and then see a quick sell-off, I think that could be the time for the NASDAQ 100 to set a low and enter a little bit more bullish situation for tech between maybe late April and late May. So you've got that continuing, like I said, cycling in and out between some of these sectors. And in answer to your question for the Dow, I do think it's got potential for a little more upside looking out further in 2022. But that's all in the context of a much bigger, higher magnitude, larger degree topping process that I've been expecting for this year.
Do cycles tend to have an order of progression? For example, could real estate drop and then the repercussions of that drop cause the stock markets to fall?
I don't know if the cycles in and of themselves indicate that, but what you're describing is something that I address in my manual of indicators that we also offer to our subscribers. But it's what I call the axiom of market correlation. And the whole premise of that is that so often traders get in their mind a certain correlation, something leading and another market or index or sector following. And the problem with that is that depending on what the whole environment is, economic, financial, geopolitical, that can, on a dime, that can shift the, not just the correlation, but which market's leading which. Because if you've got, you know, the Fed talking about higher interest rates and that drives bonds down and the bonds going down pulls stocks down, that's one thing. In another scenario, if you've got problems in the economy driving stocks down, that will often get a different focus from traders, and all of a sudden bonds would go up because they would fear economic deflationary forces, not in the current environment, but I'm just saying in general. You get that type of reverse correlation where depending on what market is leading at that exact moment in time, that determines the correlation. And sometimes that correlation is 180 degrees of what it was the last time those two markets were trading either in tandem or in opposition. And so trading off of those correlations by themselves, I think, is one of the most dangerous things that traders can do, because it's adding an extra variable into their trading analysis that might have worked in a different environment, but now, even if just one variable has changed, it can flip that whole thing on its head. And so, you know, you talk about if there's a real estate drop and then stock market, you could also have stocks dropping and all of a sudden that start to cause its own headwind in interest rates and in real estate itself. So it may be the exact opposite leading and lagging relationship between those two things. So that the cycles will certainly give some indication if there are certain markets that or certain sectors that you see peaking before others do. That may give you a hint that, okay, this market may be the one that's going to lead this downturn for whatever reason. And then looking at the fundamentals and what's really the prevailing sentiment, you may be able to build a cause and effect correlation from that, but there's a lot of other factors that need to go into that, not just a market-to-market correlation.
Canada is admitting to 6.7% inflation, the U.S. 8.5%. Can inflation cycles give us an idea of how long this significant inflation will last?
I certainly think so. My work since late 2019, early 2020 was kept focusing on this time frame from first, second quarter of 2020 into third quarter, possibly fourth quarter of 2022 as being a very inflationary time. And there were some key markets at the time that were showing major bottoms in March and April of 2020, most notably silver and the energy markets. And in both of those cases, it looked like and continues to look like the final high for those bull markets won't be until the August-September of this year in metals and September-October in overall inflation markets, including the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index is one of the tools that I use to gauge overall inflation. I'm not as much looking at things like CPI and PPI and other economic indicators, but from a broader assessment of commodity inflation, that's what my work continues to say is that a final spike high will probably stretch out into September, October of this year, and that should be the peak of that inflation. And once again, leading into that, ideally, I would see the type of divergence that I was just talking about with stocks and stock indexes, where certain commodities might be peaking now. And then we see a sell-off for a few weeks, and then there's a general upswing in commodities, certain inflation indicators. And in a month or two, certain other commodities set higher highs, whereas the ones that are peaking right now set lower highs. And then after that peak, you get another pullback. And then finally, leading into that September-October time frame, maybe it's only one or two more commodity sectors, you know, could be energy, could be grains and foodstuffs, could be metals. But one of them sets new highs while the others continue setting a series of lower highs. And that type of divergence is the ideal thing to see at a top like that. So I'm going to be watching for something very similar to that. And I think there's other factors that will be coming into play too that will start to stem the rise in inflation.
We're hearing rumblings interest rates might be headed for 20%. Do you follow short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term cycles for interest rates? And do those cycles predict when we might see a top in interest rates?
I do follow it more in the longer term. The 10-year notes and 30-year bonds have had some very consistent cycles, and I continue to discuss a couple of the really uncanny prevailing ones that have governed bonds, including a four-year cycle that helped pinpoint the top in bonds, the low in interest rates in mid-2020. And that four-year cycle does project a secondary, and by secondary I mean lower high in bonds and higher low in interest rates looking out into mid-2024. But in between that, what that cycle and a lot of corroborating ones were telling me is to look for about a 2.5 to 2.75 year updraft in interest rates and sell off in bonds. So if you have an entire 4-year cycle from high to high, in this phase of that cycle, you would expect the downswing to be longer. And I'm speaking of bonds here, interest rates being the opposite. So if there's a 4-year cycle between a mid-2020 and an expected mid-2024 high, that you would expect to see about a 2.5, 2.75 year sell-off in bonds from that mid-2020 high. And that corresponds to several other timing indicators and cycles that I've got bottoming for bonds in early 2023, so a top in interest rate. And I do think that even what we're just talking about with inflation, if some of those indicators have already started to top out in the third or fourth quarter of 2022, it would make sense that that whole interest rate upswing also be nearing an extreme. And so I'm looking at early 2023 for the low in bonds and corresponding top in related interest rates.
We're hearing predictions of up to $150 a barrel for oil. What do you see from the cycles for oil?
Oil cycles remain positive. One of the things that I've been more focused on the last 2+ years is natural gas. I had just multi-year buy signals triggered in first quarter and second quarter of 2020, and then some secondary buy signals triggered about 12 months after that, and those signals remain intact. And we're forecasting a surge that would take us through first quarter of 2022 where we are now. But even as we were starting to accelerate up, many of the indicators I use were showing me that overall uptrend is likely to extend into the fourth quarter of this year, probably with substantial sell-offs in between. Doesn't mean straight up into that time frame. But for natural gas, there's been two major upside targets since the time it bottomed around 160, 180. The one primary upside target is right around 840, 850. And we just spiked above $8 in the last week. And then the second primary upside target is at 1050 to 1150, and whether or not we can see that by year end will be heavily dependent on what happens in the next maybe 2 to 3 months. And if we do see a top around the 850 level and pull back, what type of technical damage is done or not done during that sell off will help me hone the expectations for later this year. So I do think that energy as a whole is going to remain in an up cycle, but it might be natural gas that outpaces some of the others as it's done recently.
Food shortages and inflation, how are the agricultural cycles looking?
They are very closely tied to the commodity inflation cycle that I was talking about. I had done a few reports last year and leading into early this year talking about how I thought that 2022 was going to be the time when wheat would overtake soybeans and corn, and that you had some major upside targets in wheat, the biggest one of them being that it's very likely to get back to its 2008 peak, which was up around $13.35 a bushel. And we were sitting at $6 and $7 a bushel late last year, early this year. I was sounding like I was a bit of an extremist, looking for rallies back up to those highs. And all it took was Russia invading Ukraine, and all of a sudden you saw wheat surge up to and spike above that $13 level. And I still see some additional upside in the grains leading into later this year, but I think they're entering the time right now when multi-month consolidation period is beginning to unfold. We had a very consistent 14 to 15 week cycle that was projecting an accelerated rally into early March, and this was published week in and week out in my weekly relay publication before that ever happened. And the whole thing was to look for a blow off rally into the week of March 7th to the 11th, which was right when we saw that that blow off, that parabolic move in wheat leading into a top. So that cycle was very powerfully validated, and moving forward, it just gives it more credibility as far as the next phase of that cycle and the highs that were set during that cycle. So I do think that the ag market still have some upside potential, but we have certainly expended a lot of the upside expectations for these bull markets.
As safe havens to the U.S. dollar, gold and silver look like they could be in parallel cycles.
Well, I have been trying to address the one, actually going all the way back to our conversation about market correlations, one of the ones that I am addressing and responding to more often than probably any other from readers and subscribers is this thinking that gold and the dollar, U.S. dollar, can only trade in opposition to one another. And I often will list out specific times over recent years, recent months, even throughout the last decade, where if you just go and look at the week-to-week and month-to-month progression of those two markets, they often trade in very close tandem to each other as opposed to being in opposition. And one of those has to do with the focus of traders' attention, or like I was talking about with our discussion on market correlations, what the current environment is, what's really driving traders' expectations. And the last few months are a perfect example, because ever since Russia started building up troops on Ukraine's border in November, you saw gold and the dollar steadily moving higher. It wasn't an out-and-out accelerated move at first, but then as we came into late February and cycles were still pointing to a little bit more upside potential in both, you saw that accelerated move in both the dollar and gold together on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And part of that is because it was also the correlation to the euro. And so the euro was suddenly a bigger focus as far as currency value and currency comparison to gold and the dollar. So if the euro is selling off on these tensions and uncertainty, you've got both the dollar rising against the euro and you've got gold rising against the euro as a result. And so you see, particularly the dollar index, you see them both rising in tandem. And it does appear that there is still a little more left in that correlation, or that those markets moving together. But I think when they ultimately divorce and separate based on other factors, that's when you're probably going to get some of your sharpest or most volatile time in both the dollar and gold. And I think that's out a few months from now.
Are cycles able to confirm trends that are in motion?
They certainly help to hone those trends, to time when those trends are more likely to reach fruition, and in many cases also when you're going to see the accelerated part of those trends. I talk about how a lot of markets often adhere to what I call the 90-10 rule of cycles, just a little offshoot of the general 80-20 principle. But when I'm describing that, I'm talking about how many markets, when you're talking about a specific trend, that 80 to 90% of the price move of that trend often happens in the final 10 or 20% of the cycle. And that move in wheat that we were just talking about is a perfect example. You had this 14 to 15 week cycle. It was peaking on during the week of March 7th to the 11th. And the majority of the move up in wheat happened in the final 2 weeks of that cycle. Similar to gold leading into some intermediate cycles in early March. And gold had just been very slowly building a bottom since late September of last year, then since mid-December, and all of a sudden its biggest move came in the final couple weeks of that intermediate cycle that topped out in early March. So that's one way that I use the cycles to hone and to clarify what I'm expecting out of the trends. And there are specific technical indicators that also help to time that type of that accelerated move and also the extreme of those accelerated moves. So it's many of those factors working together. It's not cycles by themselves. In fact, I use cycles more as a backdrop and kind of to set the stage, and then a lot more specific technical tools which give me better ways to manage risk control and triggering and both entry and exit into corresponding trades, and the cycles are there as the backdrop.
Has Bitcoin been around long enough that you can see definite cycles for it?
I know we've talked about this before, and I think that on an intermediate basis, yes. And part of that may also be its correlation to other markets. So even though you might not have 50 years worth of data for Bitcoin itself, there are certain correlations that give you general cycles that can be followed. But one of the interesting things I think about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general is where it fits in the entire currency arena and currency battles. And I've talked about this in many different perspectives, but I also have used the old rock, paper, scissors game as a little bit of an analogy for where I see this ongoing struggle between cryptocurrency, between hard currencies, normally I'm just referring to precious metals in that respect, and fiat currency, your debt-backed paper currencies, in particular the dollar. And it's one of those things where you often have one of those three being in a very convincing trend, and when it is, whichever one that is, when it is moving in an accelerated fashion, the other two are more constrained. And it's kind of like you've got the trader's attention on, let's say, Bitcoin in a big uptrend and accelerating higher. You'll see the dollar and gold just kind of vacillating back and forth and almost waiting for the move in Bitcoin to reach an extreme. And then when that move in Bitcoin reaches an extreme and starts to consolidate, you'll see one of the other two go into a strong trend. And so it's a bit like a three-way battle. And the other analogy I use, which maybe it's a little bit better analogy, is just a simple algebraic equation of A times B equals C, where from a trend perspective, if you can gauge or weight the trend of each of those sectors, the cryptos, the hard currency, and the paper or fiat currency, that you can only have one or two of them in a big trend at any point in time. Rarely will you see all three. So the last several months, like we were just talking about with the geopolitical tensions and whatnot, both the dollar and gold were gaining since late last year and then more accelerated in the first quarter of this year. What was happening with Bitcoin? It was selling off repeatedly and seeing a pretty big dive into early part of this year. And now we're starting to enter the time when I think the dollar and gold are more likely to consolidate, and some of my work is looking for a rebound in Bitcoin right now. Getting back to your overall question, I do think there are some short-term and intermediate cycles that are starting to become more observable and more predictable in Bitcoin. Same thing with specific technical indicators I use, that many of them on short and intermediate term basis are becoming more reliable. I definitely take it with a grain of salt when I'm looking at longer term analysis and trying to assess monthly and yearly trends, because there is such limited data, and when the whole crux of technical and cyclical analysis relies on mass psychology, that means not only mass psychology at any one day or week of time, but stretched out over a long period of time to identify those cycles and with any reliability. So I do think it has those cycles on an intermediate basis, and some of them have actually been pretty uncanny to me.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money. And just before we go, how can people follow you and subscribe to your newsletters?
Oh, well, the best way is to go to our primary website, insidetracktrading.com, and that's inside with the extra I in the middle, INSIIDE, tracktrading.com, and find a lot of archived reports and analysis there, technical trading tools, some samples of our tech tips, and also descriptions of each of the publications and each of the subscriptions and how to go about ordering them via that website.
Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com.
And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Bob Hoy, John Kaiser, and Eric Haddock. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.